on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Robert Hammond, 86 years old, is retired from a long career as an expert in the field of public health. The walls of his study in Long Beach are covered with proclamations and awards recognizing his efforts in that regard, including a stint making sure food was safe for all the athletes at the 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. But it all started for him as a teenager when he enlisted in the Navy during World War II. He has shared with us already some of the racism he encountered, something he hadn't really experienced growing up in New Jersey, the son of a black father and white mother. Mr. Hammond, let's pick up your story where we left off there.
Segregation had backfired on the armed forces at the time. In 1942, Roosevelt integrated, said put black Marines there. So they sent those men to Munford Point. Right. And the medical care, most of these guys were from the South, and they didn't get good medical care. And when they got to Munford Point, they were sick. Most of them were sick. They had worms. They had a whole bunch of other things wrong with them. The white corpsmen would not treat them. For anything they had, they gave them a Brown's mixture and cod liver oil. They had a broken arm. That's what they gave them. So they had to get some black corpsmen there. So seven of us, when we finished training at the hospital, were sent to Munford Point. But my first experiences at the Brooklyn Naval Hospital, it was very traumatic because what they did with us, they put us to work in the kitchen. The first day we got there, we were assigned to kitchen duties, washing dishes and serving food. And we had the Red Crosses on our uniforms and all that. And an officer came down there, a commander, came down. He saw this. He says, are you guys corpsmen? We said, yes, sir. He said, you're not stewards, mates. What are you doing working in the kitchen? You belong up on the wards. So he went and got the chief petty officer in charge of us. What are these men doing in the kitchen? He said, sir, we can't send them up on the wards. They would interact with the white nurses up there. And that commander told that chief, he said, look, you get those men up on the wards now. He said, if you don't do it, I'm going to bust you down. He said, the lowest rank that one of those men have is a hospital apprentice second class. I'm going to bust you down to that. So we went up on the wards. And when we went up on the wards, it was new training up there. Was up there 2 weeks. The first black Navy nurse came there. She was a full lieutenant, and she outranked most of the white nurses. And guess where they put her to work? In the linen room. So I went to work with Mrs. Daly. And we'd go out on liberty sometimes together. And she said, you're not supposed to fraternize with officers, you know. I said, well, I'm not fraternizing with you. I'm just going out to New York with you. But because I had relatives in New York that I visited, and I had a good time in New York, going over to the Savoy and all that, listening to good music. Turned 18, I go into the bars. I could get a drink. They'd serve us because we were in uniform. Sure. I didn't say anything. But anyway, the experiences at that hospital, the way the seven of us that were there, see, there were only about 21, 22. Seven of us went to the hospital for surgical duties and field training for injuries that people would get in the field. And that's what I learned. Seven other guys went to the ships. I wanted to go to the ships. I wanted to go aboard the USS Mason or the US Pelican that were all black Navy ships. I wanted to go on board one of those. But they wouldn't send me because they said I'm not old enough. They wanted guys in their 20s over there. So they sent me to the Marines. And that's when I left the Naval Hospital and went down to Munford Point. That's where a whole lot of mess started.
Well, and to wrap up that discussion about Brooklyn Naval Hospital and the prejudice that you really experienced there, I'm just curious if what the effect of that was on you. Did it, because you can laugh about it now in retrospect. I don't think you're laughing too much then. Did it anger you? Did it motivate you to prove yourself every bit as patriotic and loyal as white soldiers were? What do you think the effect was on you?
Well, being in New York and having a lot of relatives there and also in Philadelphia, I was told to persevere through that. At the time, you had a man named Walter White, who was the head of the NAACP. You had A. Philip Randolph, very prominent black man at the time. And they formed an organization called the Double V for servicemen. And this was the sign, the Double V. And that is, we had a fight overseas and we had a fight at home. One was for prejudice here, discrimination and prejudice, and the other one was against the enemies of the United States. And we had to fight those two.
Wow. And I know it's easy for you to talk about because you've talked about it so many times and you lived it. But I think for people listening, there's a certain gravity to that situation that's hitting home for them. And the situation got a little more grave and a little more dire for you when you got to Mumford Point. And explain to people what that was at the time and what was the significance of that outpost.
When I first got to Mumford Point, I didn't know what it was. It was a camp outside of Jacksonville by the New River. All black Marines were there.
The first blacks ever allowed into the Marine Corps.
Yes. They were amongst the first. The first ones were in 42, but I was there in 1944. Okay. That's when I was there. Yeah. And we went to a place called Hadnut Point where the hospital was. And then we were told, when you go to Mumford Point, we want you to survey the whole place. There was a doctor there. I think his name was Asher, Dr. Asher. He said, it's a swamp. It's mosquitoes there. The water's bad. Housing is bad. The food is bad. We want you guys to go over there and bring me back a report. And when I got over there, the guys were sleeping in wooden huts, dirt floors. Rattlesnakes would come in there. They had no windows. Mosquitoes would come in from the swamp. This was the pure swamps. Now, growing up in the swamps as a youngster, I knew what it was. And there were bears there. There were everything you'd want from a swamp was there. Skunks, all snakes, mosquitoes, all kinds of bugs that would come in. You'd think mosquitoes were bad, but they had little things smaller than them, like gnats. They would get all over you, ticks, and eat you up. When we got back to Dr. Asher, he said, well, we're going to clean up those swamps. We're going to clear it. We're going to get rid of the snakes. What they did, they built a latrine upstream from a well. Like, up here's a latrine, down here's the well. Everything from that would go down into that well. So the guys, most of those men had diarrhea all the time from that. And what happened was we had them reverse that. Then they brought in Quonset huts later on with wooden floors, metal things and screens. And we would inspect those once a week to make sure they were clean. There were no snakes, no spiders, nothing in there. That the men were clean themselves. We did short arms inspections at that time. Those men were sick, most of them. A lot of those men had lice. A lot of them had VD from the South because they didn't get any medical care. And the white corpsmen didn't give a damn about them. Just let them die. They didn't want them in the Marine Corps anyway. So what we did with Dr. Asher, and that's when I met Bobby Troop, Route 66 piano player.
Yeah, yeah.
He was captain then. And Bobby Troop set up a band, fights. I tried to box and got knocked out and I quit. But the thing was the music. I enjoyed the music and things like that there. Bobby Troop, what he did, he told us, says, you guys don't have to go to town to go to a theater. We're going to put a theater here on the base for you. You don't have to go through all that Jim Crow and racism. Because what had happened was a Marine from New York had gotten off the bus and went into the station there and asked they had brought in vending machines for cigarettes, and he walked into the white side, not paying attention. They had signs up, colored white then. He went in the white side and threw a dollar bill at the lady and asked, "Say, sweetheart, can we change for a dollar?" And she threw four quarters at him, and then she looked at him and then screamed. And then the police came and arrested him and took the guy and put him in jail. Now, word got back to Mumford Point that there was a Marine in jail down there. So it got over to Bobby Troop, Sergeant Fisher, who was white, another sergeant, very liberal people. They didn't go for that discrimination because they weren't from the South. And they said, "We're going to go get that Marine." 1,000 black Marines got in trucks with 50 caliber machine guns on it. And we went into town, in that little old town. The railroad track went right down the middle, this side, and that black people this side, white people this side. City Hall was on this side. And the police station was on that side. And we went down there. And when we got down there, they were beating this Marine up. We arrested the whole police force.
Wow.
It was about eight policemen in there, the chief of police and everybody else, and took them back to Mumford Point and put them in the brig. Then all hell broke out from that. The commandant of the Marine Corps, he came over. What are you men going into town arresting police officers for? So we told him what he did. He said, "We're not going to leave a Marine behind. What are you talking about? You're the commandant of the whole Marine Corps. Would you leave him behind?" We had Tom McFadder at the time, Sergeant Thomas McFadder. He was the one who said, "Can't leave him there." Tom wrote a book called Caught in the Middle. And he became a Navy chaplain later on. But anyway, we took the Marine back, locked those officers up. The colonel just left us alone. They said, "You guys go ahead and do what you're going to do." Just left us alone. And we kept those policemen in there for 5 days in the brig and on bread and water and turned them loose. And we told them, "Don't you ever mess with a Marine again." That's what McFadder told them. "Don't mess with any of these Mumford Point Marines." Because people were spitting on them and just harassing them and treating them mean. "Boy, where'd you get that uniform? You don't belong in it," and spit on them. They cut all that stuff, was cut out. But that was, to me, it was outrageous behavior. And I had never seen this. Here, I'm going to go fight Germans and Japanese, and here they're treating us worse than them because they had some German prisoners of war there. They treated them better than us. So that kind of got us. Later on at Mumford Point, another thing happened that's not written about, and that was the Royal Dutch Marines came to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. 5,000 of them. And these Marines had come from, I think they were over in North Africa someplace. When Hitler invaded their land, they went over there. Then they went to the Caribbean, and then they went through training. And they were there at Camp Lejeune to learn amphibious training, because they're going to reinvade where Hitler was and where the Japanese was in the Pacific. And what they said was the commandant, the Marine Corps, came and told the commandant of those Royal Dutch Marines, because they had 500 black Royal Dutch Marines. And he did not want those black Marines in Camp Lejeune. Told that commander, "Send those Marines over to Mumford Point. We segregate them here." That did not fly. That commander says, "You don't leave a Marine behind. We're not going to leave any of ours. Those are our Marines. Where they go, we go. Now, if they're going to Mumford Point, we went." So 5,000 Royal Dutch Marines went over to Mumford Point, and we had a ball with those guys. I mean, especially, after it had gone down to the beer hall and all of that, with the music and things. We had a ball with those guys. They stayed there for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they left. But that was an experience to see. And what it did to me, I said, my God, I'd write letters home to my mother and tell her about it. And she'd say, Robert, I'm going to tell you something. If people are going to be prejudiced against you, make them pay for it. Don't you ever forget them. Make them spend some money. That's the only thing they know is money. So that stuck with me throughout my lifetime. Make them pay. If they're going to discriminate against you, make them pay. But anyway, a lot was going on there with the medical corps. The Marines got better. They got better treatment. They bowed out now to a corpsman. We were the first ones in line at the chow hall. They waited on us. When we went out on liberty, they gathered around us and just took care of us. We didn't have to spend one penny for nothing if we went out with those Mumford Pointers. So when we got overseas, they still rallied around the corpsman. And the corpsman had to look, there's about four platoons. Platoon had 40 men. And that's 160 men. We had to watch them, keep an eye on them. Something happened to them, you were there with them. And they knew that. The military part of what we did at Mumford Point was outstanding. The guys were expert marksmen with artillery. They were expert. Anti-aircraft guns. They had the 51st, 52nd anti-aircraft battalions. And one day they were shooting target practice. And they said, you guys are missing the target. And they said, no, we're not aiming at the target. We're aiming at the string. And then one shell went right and clipped the target. So that happened. In marching, if you ever watch the Marines march, you'll see a swagger that they got from the Mumford Point Marines, from Big Elmo. They put these men in ammo companies and supply companies, not in combat battalions. We all had weapons. If we had to use them, we used them. But we had all the food, all the medical supplies. We had all the ammunition. We had everything the Marines would want. And we brought those to those islands.
And you ended up on Guam, is that right?
I ended up there at Camp Wise at the medical dispensary on Guam. That was, we had a small hospital there. Then over, we called it Barracuda Village, near the airfield up there in Agana, where the Marines were. That was the 51st and 52nd anti-aircraft companies up there.
We're going to stop it right there for a minute because it's break time again. We'll get the rest of Robert Hammond's story when Hometown Heroes continues after this. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need 1,000 words, just 2 of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, 2 more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you 2 more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.